Setting up shop.
Hi guys, welcome to a Patreon exclusive, or maybe we will also release this all later on in the future. Later in the future, that's great English. Dan here from Setting Up Shop, and with me today is unfortunately just the Rasmus, the Rasmouse from Norway. Heidi is tied up with the day job, so can't join us today. Hi, Raz.
Hello, how are you doing?
Generally okay. We thought we'd take this opportunity to record a Patreon exclusive episode, which, as I say, we might release in a future season. It's probably a backup as kind of like, oh no, we've run out of time to record stuff, so we can put this one in there kind of thing. But anyway, what we thought we'd discuss for this episode, if you can call it an episode, we'll worry about names many times.
Yeah, it's an in-between thing.
Yeah, an in-betweeny thing, that's the technical term. That's a perineum again, isn't it? We're not going to go through that route. It's the in-betweeny thing. Is it in-betweeny? It's a perineum episode. It's an in-between episode. I'm hopeful at least John will hear this and appreciate that. So yeah, what we thought we'd talk about after I've derailed us already is future stuff. So like plans that both of us have for our respective businesses, things that we want to try in the future, and physical moves or not, dancing moves or not, definitely not in my case. Generally
you
speaking,
say that now.
I say that. Yeah, I've said that for a long time. Yeah. So, Raz, what have you, let's start with what you've currently got going on that maybe you haven't shared with many people, if there is anything like that you can share, or at least you haven't shared on your social media, so people wouldn't know unless they've specifically spoken to you about.
Well, I think I have briefly mentioned to you off the podcast that I've been thinking about maybe starting to manufacture some blacksmithing gear.
Yes.
And maybe earlier I talked about like producing like chisels and punches and hammers and tongs and such, like using a bit of my friend group that's also blacksmith and self-employed to sort of have some of them make hammers, some of them make tongs, and trying to sort of start like a section of manufacturing with these tools in Norway. But then also the conversation got a step further and gone like, well, how about forges?
Right.
Because Devil Forge, the currently like absolute cheapest and best beginner forges on the market, are really, really cheap, but they're also really, really shit.
Okay.
So could we do something that is slightly more expensive, but vastly better quality?
Okay. So you've already identified a gap in the market.
Yes, because there is forges out there that are pretty darn good. You produce a lot in England. There's a lot few produced in Sweden. And the Germans also have a pretty good brand. And I think there's some Spanish ones that are also on the European market. That's pretty decent, pretty good. And the Americans have a lot of their own stuff going on. I don't fully know all of that, but there is something. But there seems to be like a price range gap here between like the really cheap ones of Devil Forge and everybody else.
Is that to do with the country they're manufactured in?
I mean, Spain is not that expensive of a country to produce things.
Well,
neither is the UK.
I don't know where the Devil Forge is made, so.
Devil Forge is Lithuania or Latvia. I always mix those up, but it's one of the two Baltics over there.
And it's actually made there. It's not designed there and then made in China.
Pretty certain it's made in the country.
Okay.
But they cheap out on all of the materials.
Yes.
And they probably need to have a reasonably big markup on everything to be able to sell them. So like they have min-maxed as much as they can.
Yeah.
But if I can have a slightly lower overhead but get a better quality of product, I can maybe get the price in sort of in between these two categories and hopefully hit the market.
Okay.
And the funny thing is, I think I already have like 5 or 6 people wanting to pre-order prototype.
Okay. Right. Okay. Well, that all sounds good. This sounds a little bit Dragon's Den-ish. Startup capital I don't know, you might not know what that program is.
I know it is. It's a business pitching show.
It's called Shark Tank in America, I think. Yeah, it does sound a bit like you would struggle in the sense of if you haven't, having been to your workshop, you haven't really got the space to set up a dedicated manufacturing plant for that unless you clear out a lot of space in your workshop, which you can't do because of all your other commissions and teaching and jobs. And you probably don't have room in the storage over the other side from where you are, which currently has pallets full of anvils and other stuff you've got for sale in it. So it would be interesting to see how you tackle that side of it, because obviously what you're talking about is a separate business.
Depending on how big it gets.
Well, yeah, and you can, to a certain extent, manage that. But in the UK, the reason why I bring it up like that is because in the UK, each individually registered business has a separate tax allowance.
Okay.
So it might be worth looking into that for Norway, because if you've already got your as the blacksmithing and the forge and the teaching and everything, but now you're talking about manufacturing, which is enough different that it could be a different business.
Fair point.
It might be worth looking at, do you just register it as a separate business, even if it's working out of the same property at the moment? Because then maybe you get a tax threshold for stuff that runs through that. It does mean you're going to have two sets of books and two sets of accounts and all of that.
Which gets more expensive.
Which does get more expensive. But when you're talking about buying quantity of materials to get pricing down and then manufacturing and potentially hiring people and packaging and all of that kind of stuff, it might be worth investigating that from the beginning, because although it'll have an initial higher outset, it might pay itself in the long run. I don't know. As an example of that, there's a company down the road where a guy does an awful lot of, he makes a lot of high-end woodworking tools, sort of carpenter's squares and lots of stuff for the guys who like to buy Festool. Lots of accessories for that kind of crowd. And so an awful lot of it is anodized.
Right.
And he was taking all of it to go and get anodized in a place about 15-20 minute drive away. And after about 3 months, he was like, why am I driving? Why is myself or any member of staff driving over there, dropping it off here, leaving it to get anodized, getting told 3 days, coming back in 3 days and being told, oh, we haven't started it yet, actually. And there's a delay and there's this, that, and whatever else. So he actually just had a chat with the guy who was like, not the owner, but the guy who was actually doing the work, and said, hey, do you still want to work here in 5 years' time? He was like, well, not really. He said, do you want to own your own company in 5 years' time, or at least be the manager of it? And he was like, maybe, what are you thinking? And he literally built next door to his, like 10 meters away from the place where he manufactures the parts. He opened a powder coating and anodizing company. And this guy was like the chief anodizer and whatever, who then hired a couple of his mates from the other company. And they now take work from all over the country.
Yeah.
But he opened it under a separate business name, which meant that that's got its all its own books and it's all its own tax breakout and whatever. And so he funded it from, I don't know, I assume from the profits from the first one or however he funded it. But it now means that he wants something anodized. He can literally just walk it over the road and go, can I have that in, like, I don't know, a couple of hours? I don't know how long anodizing takes. But, you know, but it also means he can experiment. He can go, oh, can we play with color? Like, can I do this and this and this? And so he's now got a separate company that will deliver things much more efficiently. So it reduces the time and the wastage, but he's also got, it's got its own revenue stream, but he's also now got the ability to experiment more and do product research more because he's got more toys to play with. So it was that as an example that made me think, oh, this is the, you know, it might be worth investigating or chatting to your accountant and seeing, is it worth you, even if it's only on paper that it's a separate company, doing a separate thing.
I mean, it's probably won't go that big right away anyway.
No, but you could put a lot of stuff under there. I mean, you could call it blacksmithtoolway.no or something like that. blacksmithtooling.no or something like that. You know, or like some really easily searchable words for when people are looking up blacksmith tool. And so, yes, you could have the manufacturing side, but you could also put like all of the tool buying and selling side under that.
Yeah.
So it's a nicely wrapped. You do whether you want to do the new and the second hand all in one place or not. I don't know. This is just the way my brain works about.
Yeah, I mean that is further ahead. I first need to actually produce a product and figure out I can make a living or make some money selling it at a reasonable price.
Yeah,
the fact that I have 5 or 6 people now that says they are more or less interested in a prototype, that means maybe I'll have 2 or 3 people actually giving me money to buy it upfront.
Yeah. So you've got, you import the grinders and the, is it another forge you import as well?
Or the Evenheat kilns.
The Evenheat kilns, yeah. So obviously kilns are different to forges, but do those guys do a forge? Do they do like, I don't know whether they do or not. I'm just wondering if you've got someone you can speak to who is manufacturing forges at that sort of level.
I have a couple of buddies that have done a lot of research and built their own forges. And I built my own forge as well. So it's more of just figuring out what sort of system to go for, what sort of standard, and what quantities do we need to buy the materials at?
See, I'm already thinking ahead. I already trusted that you would have done that part and you knew
that part.
That's not the bit I'm questioning. What I'm asking is, because what you've identified is there's cheap or there's really expensive and you're trying to find the golden one in the middle.
Yes.
So what I was wondering is, do you know anyone who's already in one of these companies who does this kind of thing, who you would feel you could trust and have a conversation with? Like maybe someone from America might be a good chance, because the market is so far away that they're not you're not going to break into their market with it. You're trying to do it for Europe. That you can have the conversation with them and they can say, hey, this is the reason why we don't do it. Here are the costs. This is where, like, maybe the, what's the white stuff that you make into bricks to put around it?
The insulation?
Yeah, whatever that stuff.
Yeah, the refractory cement.
Refractory cement. That's what I was thinking of. You know, maybe like the refractory cement, when you're trying to buy in certain quantity, there's a cap as to how cheap it will be.
Yes.
You know, and like, so then if you're wanting to make X amount of forges per month in order for it to be viable, then you have to buy X amount. Well, that means you've got a huge stock of it. And then I don't know, maybe it's more susceptible to damp or something, or it's got a time. You know, all this kind of stuff. Mm. That's so, what I'm thinking about. You need to ask someone about not the prototyping and making the thing, but the step forward to the actual mass production element of it.
So I have two benefits already there. I've already developed somewhat of a relationship with an industrial furnace building company.
Excellent.
Just outside of Oslo.
Excellent, yeah.
And they previously cast the tops for the gas forges I built previously.
Okay.
And basically going to them and asking, like, so if I need custom parts, they can cast them for me. I can probably buy at a good price sheets of stones or whatever in all of the various sizes. That's normal.
Yeah.
And I also talked to them previously a little bit about how to build forges and what's required.
Yeah.
The interesting thing, though, is they work at such a big different scale that a lot of their expertise isn't necessarily relevant.
Yeah.
And one of the things I've realized with my gas forge, and this is specifically also after having Joe over and talking to him about sort of using mine for the axe making class he had here back in February.
Yeah.
It's sort of like, oh, like the big gas forge, the big ribbon burner I have, it's severely underpowered. But part of volume of space inside. But part of the reason for that is that the fabrics I'm using are very hard and not so insulating.
Okay.
So if I actually go for the fabrics that are softer, will wear out faster, but insulate a hell of a lot better, the whole forge will be lighter. It will heat up quicker. It will be more efficient to use in theory. That's one of the parts I need to test. And this is like sort of just branching off of different things, because like, the one I have is brilliant when it's gotten up the heat, but it takes like 90 minutes for it to fully heat up.
Cool. Right. Okay.
You want that time to be less than 10.
Yeah. So you've already got like, I know it won't be a mental list. It'll be a Notion list. You've got a Notion list of like key points you want to hit that make it different from other people's forges. And I think actually, making it clear that you're using if you go down that route, you're using a softer brick because then it will heat up faster, but it does mean the bricks will wear out faster. But that also then means you're building in repurchasing of accessories for the forge right from the get-go.
And we're talking, they will wear out faster, but that's only relevant probably like a 5-year time frame for hobbyists, maybe 10.
Yeah. So you're not, it's not like they're doing it every 3 months and that's going to be an expense, which means it's going to put them off buying it. So most importantly out of this whole thing then, what name have you come up with for it?
That I haven't yet.
Because you can't cop out and just call it the Viking Forge, but I do feel like
the Swedish company already has like the Viking names. They have, Njord Fjord Forges, and Njord is one of the Viking gods.
Yeah, but you want to have like, there's got to be at some point someone like Thor did something. Well, in fact, we can even go down the Marvel route. Who is it that when they forged the hammer, what was the name of the furnace or whatever they called it?
In Marvel, I'm not sure.
When he got the axe made in space with the giant space dwarf.
You could call it Dinklage. Peter Dinklage.
I don't think calling it a Dinklage Forge is a good idea.
It could be the smallest one. Come on.
No, I don't think using actors' names who have physical proportionality is
okay,
the best plan.
Never mind.
But just from the point of view of like if you search for something,
why not just call it a Luan Forge?
Because there's nothing. What I would do is call it something like Viking Forge by Luan. Because
you want
the search engine name at the beginning.
Yes. Yeah. Okay.
That's what I'm thinking. Because this is something that's been bugging me more and more. I was sat at an event last weekend, surrounded by wood turning clubs and wood turners and people doing stuff with wood. All right. There's only about 10 of them in this room, but I was just looking around. And obviously, we all know that, like, I've got no marketing background or anything like that, you know, all this kind of thing, but worked in retail a long time and marketing friends and had conversations. And I'm just looking around, I'm like, the names people have chosen, atrocious.
Yeah.
Like, they mean something to that person personally. And I mean, this is the same with me when I created Bevel. Like, Bevel was, oh, this is cool. This is, like, artsy and whatever else. It's like, yeah, but what do they do? Mm. Like, what is it? What is the thing you do? And there was one company there that was called something like A.Tree.Woodsman or something like that. And so it would become ATW was like the shortened version of it. But the way it was written on the poster, they actually had the A, then the period, as the Americans would call it, tree period woodsman. And I was just like, a tree woodsman? Hmm. What does that mean? Like, you're a person who is a tree and a woodsman? You're a person who, like, had no idea what that means. What that means to me is, if I see that, and it was a really poorly designed and written poster and everything else like that, what that means to me is, if I was at a craft fair, is I wouldn't give it the time of day. I just wouldn't walk up to it at all. Mm. Now, you know, or if it was a shop or anything where I'm looking at that sign or poster, I'm going to skip past it. So all I'm thinking is you want your forge name, not that, oh, it needs to sound cool, but it needs to appeal to a broader audience of people who are buying forges as possible, but still tie into, this is made in Norway, you know, this is where, yeah, as much as possible, this is manufactured in Norway. So this is like, you know, whether you want to lean into the made by Vikings, you know, or whatever you want to call it.
I mean, my mind immediately goes to the fjords then.
Yeah.
Just use those, basically.
Yeah, but that's for individual, like, model names. I'm talking, yeah, like an overall kind of, because so you've got,
like a,
you know.
Yeah, like a product series name kind of.
Yeah. I mean, well, you know, the forge, you've got the even heat kiln. Let's use that as the example. Oh, it's a kiln and it gives me an even heat. I mean, like, that literally, if anyone searches for kiln and even heat, that's what's going to pop up. So you kind of want to find that really standard, almost boring name, but, like, you know, I don't know, quick to temperature forge or something like that. You know, like, what would be something you would search for if you were an amateur? Maybe worth asking, like, 15, 20, ask your mailing list and say, hey, if you were to search for a forge, what are the top three search engine, you know, top three things you would put into a search engine?
Hmm.
You know, and most of them are going to come back with forge for sale. Like, yeah. Do you know what I mean? But you want, like, you want that kind of thing of, what does it do and what is it? It would be something like easy to use blacksmith forge, or gas blacksmith forge, or quick to heat blacksmith forge, or something like that. But, you know, obviously you then want to try and make it snappy.
Good.
Yeah. I mean, you could just go down with Viking forge. Like, there's no reason why you couldn't do that, unless there was one that was directly in competition. But you know, it just feels a bit like a cheap shot.
Yeah, the Swedes already done that whole Viking part of it.
Yeah.
So,
doesn't mean you can't.
I mean, yeah, it just starts to get confusing. If I want them to find mine, I want them to find mine, and not,
yeah,
they don't remember fully the name they're thinking of, and then they're thinking of either the Swedes or me, and they find the wrong one, so to speak.
Yeah, but it's the Ford, but you don't, you know, that doesn't work.
Sorry, say again.
Hephaestus,
yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah. But that's
Greek. Yeah,
that's the Greek god of forging and volcanoes, yeah, or something. Vulcan, of course, is the Roman one.
Yeah,
yeah. No, that's definitely something to think about. And I mean, the problem here is kind of just going on the name, something that works in Norwegian and maybe in English, but most importantly in Norwegian.
Yeah,
because, like, I'm not actually planning to suddenly stop forging and only make forges.
No,
but
absolutely.
If I can just make, I mean, between 5 and 10 a year, that would be awesome.
Yeah.
But, and again, this is kind of also just me saying, like, well, I need to build a new forge. I need to redo all of these things. Why don't, and I already have a customer base willing to buy forges and looking for forges. So they're sort of like, what's the difference between buying one or five, or buying parts for one or five?
Exactly. But you also want to be able to have options, in the sense of, you want, like you've had recently, oh, I need to be able to put a sword in this.
Yeah.
Like, so you know, there's a size thing. But then equally, as you said earlier, some people just want to make knives. And so actually they only need one that's like a foot long. They don't need, like, all of, and then maybe they haven't got room. Maybe they only need a single burner or whatever, all of this kind of stuff.
Mm.
But yeah, it might, so you've got options there. I'm obviously going off at the deep end in my head of going like, oh, mass production, how do you make money? You've got to optimize and all of that kind of stuff. But it's also that thing of, like, You're experienced and intelligent enough to do all of this, but I'm just trying to push those little buttons that make you think a little bit more, kind of. I can totally understand you're in the product design and, like, the research and refinement phase.
Yeah.
But it helps to have that overall vision at the end of, like you've just said, oh, I want to do like four or five of these a year, blah, 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 which is fine. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with that at all. But just, you know, just calling it like, oh, do you want a Forge Bro kind of thing?
Yeah.
Doesn't, you know, like if you got to the point where actually, oh, okay, you do four or five of the years. Oh, no, actually, I'm now doing 10 of these a year. Or, you know, every time you see Fortune and Fire is going to be repeated on your local TV show or whatever, you chuck out a little advert somewhere and it you know, boosts access to your classes and sales of your tools and all that kind of stuff. Again, I mean, it's easy for me to tell other people what to do without doing it myself.
Of course, that's the easiest in the world. And it's really good advice. And I definitely should try to future-proof this as much as possible.
Yeah, because you could get to a point where it's big enough that you can't handle it and then someone offers you money to buy it off you. But that's when you don't want it to be called the Lowen Forge anymore, because if they take it and then change the design or make it rubbish, that's your name.
Yeah.
That's then, you know, whatever, or the fjord's name or however you want to look at it. But if it's called something like, you know, anvilpimp.com forge or something.
Yeah. Well, we're back to that now. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
The Pimpin' Forge, that's something.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, all of that kind of stuff. It's just, and this is very much commercializing, and I've forgotten the terminology now, that we're all worshipping at the thing of mammon of wanting money. But anyway, but yeah, that sounds exciting though. Circling way back to your original statement of like things you've got going on that you want to do in the future. That certainly does sound quite interesting.
Well, with the future, I kind of hope to have the first prototype done in the next few months.
Okay.
Because there, in my mind, there's two times. There's now and not now.
Yeah, which is, you know, the book's filed under not now, and you've got other stuff filed under now.
Don't bring that up again. It's fine.
Yeah, it's fine. My book's filed under not now as well. So I'm just not as far along or have money towards mine. That's
yeah. Anyway, yeah. Last bit of things that's so kind of fun with the whole Gasforge thing is also figuring out like all of the, like you talked about, like all of the elements that needs to fit together. And also with the laser cutting company I've been working with for so long, like just getting parts cut by them is also just going to save so much time instead of trying to do anything in-house.
Yeah. But it's also, what does it look like? I mean, if you think of, I'm going to forget her name as well now, metal artist in America, she was on the welding program.
Leah Arapoch?
Yeah, Leah. I mean, you look at her forge.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, no one's going to mistake that forge for anyone other than Leah's forge.
Absolutely.
For those of you listening to this episode, either on Patreon or when it's released later, if you're listening it when it's released later, then, you know, hey, if you'd subscribed to the Patreon account, then you would have got it when it was first released. But Leah Arapoch is absolutely amazing metalworking artist, absolutely fantastic. But her forge, the way she has crafted the look around it, I mean, it's a work of art in its own right. It's just absolutely stunning. You could find her on Instagram and have a look at it, and it's fantastic. I really like, I mean, the stuff that she makes her art out of can be quite disturbing for some people, so just bear that in mind. It can come a bit sort of
a bit of a creepy alien vibe to some of it.
Yeah
It's still fucking good.
Yeah, like very, very impressive, like once it's all finalized and all that kind of thing. But yeah, that's definitely, you don't look at that and go, how do I mass produce this?
You just could say no.
Yeah. That's someone who's comfortable with what the forge can do for her, so that she's then built the artistry around it. It's kind of the equivalent of a woodworker making their own workbench. Like, you know, they've been woodworking for 15, 20 years and they go, right, now I'm going to make the workbench that is my workbench because it does everything I need it to with the space in the right place and all that kind of thing. Cool.
What about you though, Dan? What's the future like for you now?
So there's a couple of different things future-wise. One is, unfortunately, having to move, so losing the current workshop. So that's a little bit up in the air as to what space I will have whenever I end up where I end up. I will have a temporary workshop space at the day job, potentially in evenings and maybe at the odd weekend. So I won't be completely without a workshop space at all, but it won't be my space.
Right.
And that's going to be the hardest thing, is like having to take your tools in each time and your work in each time, and then having to tidy up at the end of each time rather than just leaving a mess and walking back in when you're next available to, all of that kind of thing. So that's going to make that a bit awkward. But yeah, the actual space in the future is I don't know. I literally have no idea what it's going to look like. I know what I've got in my head of what I'd like to do.
Mm.
And I was talking to you before we started recording. One of the current things that I've got in my mind is investigating whether or not I buy a flat outright. So there's no mortgage on the flat. And then I potentially buy a commercial property with a mortgage so that if for whatever reason I need to move again, or, you know, flat reason or whatever, then it doesn't affect the workshop. The workshop is just where it is. And commercial property tends to hold or go up in value, generally speaking. So that might be a better way of investing for the future, but also means that I might be able to get a larger workshop space than sort I currently have.
Yeah, sort of comparative to what would be attached to a property.
Yes. Because looking around the price range of what I could afford in this area, there's a lot of properties around, not many of them with gardens. Or if they've got a garden, it's very difficult to access. Or even if it's got a garden and it's difficult to access, there's still not necessarily room to have even the space as big as I've currently got put there. And I'm not entirely sure how friendly my friends would be with me after asking them to carry all of the machinery through a house, out through a back garden, up two flights of steps, and then into a workshop. So, yeah, there's a lot of things to consider there. And it was just that thought of, is it just going to be easier? Because, like, living space, I don't need a whole house, really. So would it just be better to go for something like a flat and then a separate workshop space, which theoretically would mean that it's big enough that I've got that mysterious extra room that I can then start doing things like buying anvils for random Norwegians and storing them in a corner without tripping over them. And then, you know, it's got a roller shutter at the front, so having someone turn up and just wanting a pallet to load straight up, and it's like, there you go, off we head, you know, and all of that kind of thing.
That sounds like a room that's really important to have.
Yes, yeah, I thought you'd think that. but also, you know, if I wanted to teach and everything, it's not, I could leave an area set up for that rather than, oh, I've now got to move everything around. And commercial units tend to have a higher voltage powered out to them as well. You know, there's also the potential there that I might be able to get, over time, bigger machinery that's more industrial or light industrial, so that I can be more efficient in making certain things. But yeah, I don't know. That's something I've got to discuss with mortgage type people and all of that sort of thing. But that's the administration, but a daydream. But actual work wise, I finished a small commission today. I started playing around with a couple that I've had not on hold, but I've been pondering the best ways to do them for a little while. And I'm making baby steps towards getting those done. And then, yeah, I had a commission for a local cabinet maker's accepted this week, just gone, which could be quite lucrative, providing I can deliver it, because they want 60 acorns turned that are 2 inches high with a little peg stuck out the bottom, you know.
Like drawer pull kind of thing?
No, so let's call it a drawer pull, but it's going to be 2 inches high, so they're quite big, but they're going to be part of a decoration, but they then get passed to a wood carver, and he's going to then carve the outsides of them, and then they complete this decoration. It's either going to go around like the ceiling cornicing or something like that. I'm not entirely sure where it's going.
Okay, but yeah, still, cool.
Yeah, they want 60 all the same, and so I gave a quote which, given how quickly it was accepted, was clearly too low.
Or they're really desperate, just saying.
Well, no, I mean, but I either way, the experience for me, and as long I budgeted time-wise 15 minutes per item, which realistically, I might not achieve that for the first 10, but you'd like to think that by the final 10, I should be down to 10 minutes or 5 minutes per item. The most important thing is just not to rush, just to like make sure they're all correct and hope that you make money at the end of it. And if you don't make money at the end of it, then you've definitely priced yourself too low, because they're providing the timber. So literally all I'm doing is it's my time, power, some abrasive, and that's it, really. Yeah, we'll wait and see. That could be quite exciting, though. Like, the frustration would be is that side of it is, I can feel that it's ready for me to like push it along and get better. But obviously I'm now moving house, closing the workshop down, and don't have a van. So like there's all this potential for like, oh yeah, you could start doing the markets again, and you could start like doing this and you could do that. But I'm also then having to rein it all in. I've had confirmation from a woodturning magazine that'd be happy for me to write them an article, which is great. But I need to actually make the thing, take photos as I'm going along, provide alternatives, do the whole piece of work, which is absolutely fine. And I can potentially do that before I close the workshop up, provided commissions are all done. Because you need to do what's guaranteed money before you do the not so guaranteed money.
Yeah,
I mean, don't get me wrong, but the article will pay quite nicely, depending on how long it takes me to make the piece, take the photographs, and write the stuff for it. Because obviously, I get to sell the piece at the end of it anyway, and it's one of my stock line items. So yeah, it's kind of there are certainly things in the back of my mind to do in the future, and I've certainly got a lot more demonstrations being booked and things like that. So I think I've got six booked for next year now.
Yeah. What's the news on that now? The stats on that? Because you basically sort of cold emailed a bunch of woodturning clubs.
Yeah. So I've still got a couple of the clubs that I cold called with emails. One of them said to me, I think it was last weekend. They said, oh, yeah, you're Dan. I was like, yeah. He said, yeah, yeah. We haven't forgotten about you. We definitely want you to come. We just haven't had that meeting yet to work out the dates for next year or whenever it is. So, you know, it's committees of clubs by people who are retired. So it takes time for things to be like booked in.
But how many people, how many bookings did you get out of how many emails?
Just having a look.
Okay.
I was probably a little bit cautious, and I tried not booking anyone in before. I didn't want to book anyone in the winter purely because the vehicle I'm driving is not best in cold and wet and all the rest of it. And then I was probably being a bit too cautious. So I've got, what have I got? One booked in March, got one booked in April. I've got one in May, but that's not from the email. One, two. It's making great audio content, me going through my phone.
Oh, it's perfect. It's brilliant. Also, we can edit and post.
Yeah, so I emailed about maybe eight clubs, and I've had three confirmed bookings.
That's all right.
Yeah, from as a result of that email. I've got other bookings as well, including the potential three-day one at a steam rally that I've spoken about on the thing before. And I had a guy at this turning event I went to last week, who's been a regular customer of mine for a number of years, although I've not met him before. It's normally been email or phone. And I was talking to someone about doing some bandsaw stuff, and he said, oh, would you be willing to come to do a club demo with the bandsaw? And I was like, potentially. I'm like, what are you talking about? He said, well, obviously that's not going to take that long, and we need to fill a 2-hour spot. And I was like, well, I can do an hour on setup and maintenance of a bandsaw and stuff. I can bring like a little benchtop one, which I literally just bought out someone's workshop and they had one. So I've got one now.
Nice.
And so I could do setup and maintenance on a bandsaw that I can bring with me. And then the second half, I can like, I don't have to cut it on the bandsaw, but I can take like a green piece of wood as if I've just cut it on the bandsaw and then rough turn it. So we can go, right, okay, so this would be the process. You've got your log, you've got your bandsaw set up, you take your piece out, you cut it, and then this would be the next part. And I really like that idea, and I sent them a quote for my, you know, how much it would be, and they've accepted straight away. So that was all booked in pretty swift. So that was quite cool. And I've got this Saturday at the day job, I'm doing all day demonstrating there. And last time I did that, I had three clubs book me. I don't think it'll be quite as productive this time round, because that's most of the clubs in the local area now who have seen me, who have already booked me. That doesn't mean I won't get some from further afield. The one in Hereford booked me as a result of this one. So I just need to, I was going to get a pull-up banner designed and printed and done ready before I got to the event. And I've just not got around to faffing around with the designing of it. So I think it's probably too late now. We've got Tuesday, Wednesday, it's 4 days before the event. It's just whether or not it's worth me theoretically rushing a banner, which is a risk, at an event where I'm going to be one of 10 wood turners.
And, you would stand out, probably.
Possibly, yeah, possibly. I might have a look at that a little bit later this evening after dinner or something and do something then. Yeah, other than that, I mean, I've got the problem is, as much like yourself, I've got various projects I want to do. Like, I don't know if I've announced on here, but there's a book that I want to work on. I've got some ideas for, but I think that's going to be, that's certainly put on the back burner at the moment while I've got, you know, house move and other stuff going on. But it will tick away in the back of my mind for a while. I've got, trying to think of things to kind of try and make sure that demonstrate my demonstrations stand out from other people's. Like, trying to do things a bit different. I've got to start thinking of demonstrations for next year because I've demoed at some of the clubs I've been to. I've been to twice now. So I've now got to come up with actually a brand new demonstration because each time it's been slightly different, but kind of building on a theme from the previous time. So like the new clubs next year can have the demo I'm currently doing, but the older clubs, it's like, oh, I actually need to come up with something a bit different now. So that's going to push me a little bit to what do I show? You know, if I had written the magazine article and it had come out already, I could then turn what I do in the magazine article to kind of help promote that. But that's not something I could do at the club anyway, because I normally use my vacuum chuck, which is really noisy.
Yeah. Silly question about that. Like, at what sort of difficulty level are you aiming for with your demonstrations?
So I currently make a couple of different projects rather than one big one. I start off by turning an oval hammer handle.
Ah.
So showing how to turn on a lathe rather than just a circle, you can turn an oval. And it's pretty simple as long as you've got the right kind of spiky bits called centers in your lathe.
You're just working offset from center.
Yes. Yeah. So you mark out your center point at either end and then you measure and accurately put, like, let's say 6 mil either side, which is close enough to 1/4 inch to call no difference unless you're an engineer, in a straight line. And then you just like mount it at those points and then you can spin it and it will turn a certain amount. And then you've made an oval. So I start with that because first of all, that warms me up. Second of all, 50% of the audience at wood turning club have either forgotten you can do that because they don't use it at home or they've never seen it.
Yeah.
The other 50% go, oh, okay, this is going to be not necessarily interesting, but oh, I've seen that before, but it won't take that long.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like me turning a bowl, which would be like if you demonstrate it and you're talking the whole time, that's like an hour. Mm. So that's where I'd like, okay, that's my start point. And then I will make a bud vase, which again is a project that either people have seen, but maybe they've not done themselves, they've never got round to it, or they haven't ever seen it before. And it's a quick and easy project. And you use up scraps from offcuts from other things that you will have done. So you're not wasting timber. But I will take that.
How big are the bud vases?
The bud vases are about 3.5 inches tall at max.
Oh, yeah, that's pretty.
They're quite small, and they're only for dried flowers. I'm not putting a test tube in them to hold water or anything like that, because that's the thing. This is like your start project. You can then make them bigger and bigger, and they can become a product, but they don't need to be. So you can literally put a piece of square stock straight into a chuck. You don't have to do anything fancy. Just put it in the chuck, tighten it up, shape a load of things, drill a hole in it, make all your shape, cut it off. Then you turn it. Then this is where most people go, oh, yeah, no, I've made a bud vase. And it's like, yeah, but now we take the extra step, which is at that point, the bottom of that piece is ragged from where the tool you've used to cut it off. Some people go, oh, yeah, well, I sand that. And it's like, no. Now you make a little mandrel, which goes back in the chuck. And on that mandrel, you have turned a piece of wood that is the same diameter as the drill hole that you've made in the piece.
Yeah.
Then you thread that on. And you show them how you just literally friction fit that on. And then you turn the base again to smooth it off and sand it and finish it. So now the whole piece is completely finished, or you can put your brand on there or whatever you're going to do. And then I take that off the lathe. And then I put a whole triple wheel buffing system on. And I take it, right, we've done finish, but now we're going to really finish it. And we're going to make this shiny and we're going to make it really, like, you know, we're going to finish it with Canuba wax. So it's got a really high sheen, but it's nice, like, friction heat resistant finish and all that kind of stuff, so it will pop quite nicely. So a small thing that's shiny with a nice grain. Cool. So you build the kind of thing, and then the final bit that I do, if I've got time, is I go, right, so that oval piece we turned at the beginning, right, I now cut a bit off that and we make that into a bud vase. So exactly the same process, but now you've gone, and that's the bit where I've seen one or two of the old boys who have seen the oval thing before, they've seen the bud vase thing before, maybe they've not seen the mandrel before, but you know, they're very experienced. They suddenly go, hang on a minute, you're doing what? It's like, I'm going to turn an oval into a bud vase, because on a circle, in order to stop it rocking, you put a curve on the bottom. If it's an oval, if you put a curve on the bottom, then it's rocking on 2 points.
Yeah.
So you have to make that really nice and flat on the base, and then you have to do this, but it's already an oval, so you can't sand the sides because then it won't be an oval anymore.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, you've got questions that need to be answered. You've got problems to solve. So you start with a thing, and then you develop it. So it should be that everyone in that room comes away thinking about, how would I do that differently, or how can I add that into something I'm already doing, or there is a technique they can see that they can apply to a different problem they've already got. And that's the way I like to approach demonstrations. Obviously, that's built over time, that particular one. But now I need to come up with a new one.
Yeah.
And go, right, okay, so I'm not just an offset bubfars guy. What else do we do? And how do we achieve the thing? Because you can't just keep turning bowls.
I'm realizing, though, you have set up this class basically like it's a joke. You have two basic premises, and then people go like, oh, it's going to be more of the same. And then you surprise them with something very different at the end.
Okay. That's really interesting. I hadn't considered it like that. But yeah, that does seem to apply really well.
And I think also, actually, that is a really good framework to construction classes like this. As if you're going to like a mixed audience of all kinds of experiences and skill levels, going like, here's basic, here's somewhat medium, and now you combine them and do something different.
The big thing with I found from having been sat in the audience at clubs and at work with having demonstrators there, the big thing is the people that are the demonstrators, people will come back and see every time, yes, are talented, but they are also entertainers.
Yeah.
They know how to banter. They know how to add a bit of jeopardy. They know how to make sure that they have pre-warned people in a subtle way that something might be about to happen. Whether it does or not doesn't necessarily matter. But if you make a mistake, or if something comes flying off the lathe, you know, one that a lot of people go is, oh, well, you know, you're in the seat ready to catch and all of this kind of stuff. If something comes, you know, which is a little bit like a bit hammy kind of, everyone says that. But my favorite one I did recently was like, I was at a club where there were a lot of very experienced wood turners. Like the guy, one of the guys in there was the founding father of the Register of Professional Turners that I'm now a member of. Okay. So he'd set that up in like late 70s, early 80s or something. I'm not entirely, I can't quite remember. And I was marking out how to do this off-center turning. And he just piped it and said, Dan, why do you do it that way and not this way? And just without thinking about it while I'm doing it, I said, because in the book that I read on how to do this, that's the way it told me how to do it. I was just like, and so that's the way. And half the audience laughed.
Yeah.
Because clearly the timing, the delivery for it was appropriate. And it wasn't being smug. It wasn't being arrogant. It was going, hey, look, the way I learned it is this and whatever. Yeah. But it wasn't because this is the way I learned to do it.
Yeah.
It was self-deprecating as well. Mm. So there's that level there. And that's not to say that I'm an expert at doing any of this at all. But I'm very fortunate that from a very young age, I've stood up in groups of people and done stuff publicly, whether it's reading out from the Bible at church or whether I'm performing or doing stuff. Standing in front of a group of people who have got a level of understanding of what I'm doing, I'm quite comfortable there. So that gives me the ability to then push and play a little bit. The one thing I have to find out before I demonstrate is I always find a club member that I kind of know and say, hey, are you guys quiet or do you shout out?
Yeah.
Because if I know beforehand that they are quiet for everyone, then it doesn't bother me that they're being quiet. If I don't know that, then I will try hard to elicit in a response. And if you try too hard, that's where it gets to be not enjoyable because people go, oh, he's doing a bit too whatever.
He's trying too hard.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've not been to a club yet that haven't invited me back. So I must be doing okay.
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely say so.
So it's definitely something I enjoy doing. But yeah, that's going to bounce around my head now for the next couple of days. Thanks, Raz, about building it up like the setup of a joke. Definitely. It's finding the new set of projects that you can demonstrate, because obviously you've got a time constraint of 2 hours with a break in the middle. So you've got to think of either a series of projects or one big project that's got enough interest to hold people there. I've had one person fall asleep. Because most of these things are in the evening. They normally start at about 7, maybe 7:30. They go on till about 9, 9:30. You know, like it's not late, but it's late enough for an audience with an average age range of over 55.
Yeah.
I would say actually, if you're in your 50s, you're probably one of the younger ones there. I normally bring down the average age group.
That fits my impression as well.
Yeah, I need to focus on a new demonstration and just make sure that I don't take my foot off the pedal, basically, that there's always something going on and I'm always letting people know that I exist. And maybe I drift into commissions for a bit and demonstrations for a bit while we worry about location and having a workshop.
I think it's good to have a little bit of something to tinker with when you sort of are looking for something to relax with or downtime or just changing gears and sort of keeping that momentum going forwards. It's just sort of on a parallel track.
Yeah. I mean, the thing I'm worried about is when I don't have a workshop for a period of time and I move, is there's a risk of me going, oh, well, I'll start going to the gym because I'm going to be close to a gym and whatever. And I want to get back into being healthy again and working out and whatever, which is fine. But then there's a risk that that will become my new thing that I obsess about, which will then take me away from, I could go wood turning tonight, but actually I could do an hour in the gym. And then once I've done an hour in the gym, I won't feel like doing it and all that kind of stuff. So I'm very conscious of that, and I will need to be kind of sort of, I mean, that's part of the reason why the podcast is good, because it helps keep me grounded. And it's like, oh, well, if I've not turned anything for like 6 months, it's going to be a bit redundant me being here.
Yeah.
So, keeping things going. I think that's been a good conversation. I think we haven't drifted off too far too often. We're very sorry, Heidi, that you weren't here. We hope that you listened to this and that you are mildly upset that you missed it. You know, just that brief little bit of like, aw, kind of element.
Yeah.
But don't worry, because this is predominantly to Patreon listeners. And to all Patreon listeners, we're going to talk, I'm going to speak in one of the future episodes. If you are one of the Patreon listeners and this is you doing it, we seem to have one listener in Japan. Now, it might be they're using a VPN, but I really hope they're not. And I really want to find out. I'm just really curious. It's like, who's this one person who's actually listening to a lot of our episodes who's in Japan? This is really cool. Not that the rest of you listening isn't cool, but you know what I mean. So yeah, thank you very much, guys. Thank you for supporting us through Patreon. And for those of you who are listening to this for free when it gets released in the future, that's absolutely fine too. We are really grateful to everyone who does listen to me ramble and to the others chiming in and stopping me talking so much. And please feel free to share our podcast with as many people as you can. It's free to listen on all of the usual places. Please feel free to reach out to us on social media. It's at setting_up_shop, SHOPPE, or myself at tarrants.co.uk, or to Erasmus at Erasmus. Oh, hang on. No, it's Lowensmed, isn't it?
Lowensmed.no.
Lowensmed.no. I don't know why I've got that wrong today.
And Rasmus Lowen at Instagram. And all
there you go. That's what it was. At Rasmus Lowen on Instagram. Mm. And at Whitehall_pottery as well, if you want to get hold of the lovely Heidi. Thank you very much, Rasmus. And we'll stop the recording there. Beep, boop, beep.
Bye-bye.